Today, the times, they are a-changin'. The DFA Daily to the 27th of August 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look at a central bank rate hike, what's happening in regional Australia and strategies for growth there, ASIC's change of direction under new management, falling broker remuneration, and Westpac bringing mortgage processing jobs back to Australia after another failed attempt at offshoring. First, as CNN put it, the hottest debate among economists and investors is when central banks will back away from pandemic-era policies. After months of ambiguity, they finally have an answer, to at least from South Korea. The Bank of Korea raised its base interest rate from 0.5% to 0.75% on Thursday. It was its first hike in 3 years and the first by a major Asian central bank in the wake of COVID-19. The decision, which comes one day before the virtual meeting of US central bankers typically held in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, underscores the tough choices facing policymakers at a delicate moment. The move is aimed at reining in inflation, a red-hot real estate market, and high levels of household debt, which the central bank decided were more worrying than a spike in coronavirus cases. The country has been battling a fourth wave of COVID-19 infections, reporting more than 1,000 daily cases since July. Today's decision to hike rates, even as the economy faces headwinds from the virus outbreak, was a statement of intent that the BOK is serious about clamping down on financial risks, Alex Holmes, Asia economist at Carroll Economics, told clients. City economists are penciling in another Bank of Korea rate hike in November and two more next year. The decision, which comes one day before the virtual meeting of US central bankers typically held at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, underscores the tough choices facing policymakers at a delicate moment. On one hand, central bankers don't want to wait too long to act, feeding dangerous price increases and a bubble in asset prices. But they're also fearful of moving too soon and jeopardising the economic recovery, especially as the Delta variant disrupts some businesses and generates a lot of uncertainty. South Korea, for its part, is making the choice that economic activity is resilient enough at this point to intervene. The Korean economy has continued its sound recovery, the central bank said in a press release, predicting that the output will grow by about 4% this year. Although private consumption has been somewhat slow due to the coronavirus resurgence, exports have sustained their buoyancy and facilities investment has shown a robust trend. Labour market conditions have continued to improve. The Bank of Korea is definitely ahead of the curve. While the Federal Reserve could start slowing down purchases of bonds this year, officials don't expect to start hiking interest rates until 2023. But as the Fed's top brass gather for their high-profile conference on Friday, they'll face similar considerations. Given the ongoing strength of the economy, when is the right time to change course? And does Delta change the picture? But as I said yesterday, my own view is it's quite unlikely the Fed will accelerate anytime soon, given the current situation that we're seeing with regard to economic performance in the US. Now, back here in Australia, with the COVID-19 pandemic heightening interest in growing Australia's regions to drive new economic activity and potentially reduce the urban congestion and housing affordability pressure in Australia's capital cities, new Ahuri research has investigated international strategies and Australian case studies to find what best might support future development. The research, population growth, regional connectivity and city planning, international lessons for Australian practice, was undertaken for Ahuri by researchers from the University of Sydney and Harvard University. Overall, the study found that there is no single best model for regional planning. development or governance. Rather, there's been a general trend towards place-based regional interventions which focus on unique regional attributes and opportunities. Our research revealed that successful regional areas across Australia shared a number of similarities, said lead author of the research, Professor Nicole Gurran from the University of Sydney. They all benefited from being close to a larger state capital city or, in the case of Albury or Dyer, from being an important transport and logistics interchange on the New South Wales and Victorian border. In addition, they all have important regional service roles as administrative headquarters for local and sometimes state services and health, education, commercial and retail services. In virtually all of the Australian regional cities examined, the largest industry sectors in terms of employment were healthcare and social assistance, followed by either retail or education. The research highlights the importance of infrastructure, transport and telecommunications infrastructure in attracting and sustaining employment and population in regional areas. It shows that high levels of government support through funding grants, decentralisation of government agencies, and investment in universities, hospitals and other major facilities have helped diversify local economies and have led to the creation of high-quality local jobs. A clear message to emerge is that population and economic growth are not on their own sufficient to drive sustainable and balanced employment outcomes, and that success should be measured more broadly by also looking at livability, environmental impacts and the social impacts of growth, said Professor Gurran. Although none of the international case studies examined were unambiguously successful, they offer several insights, including the importance of long-term regional planning and coordination, with success building over time, and the importance of setting concrete regional-level targets for balanced housing and job development. The case studies also revealed that when selecting new opportunities for economic specialisation and growth, it is important to identify industries that have long-term high-value potential. In the current period, this would include those not susceptible to automation. It also means identifying opportunities that can be outsourced from major cities to regional Australia and where regions have advantages over international outsourcing. The shift to the regions could be the precursor of a rebalancing of Australia's settlement and population growth, but it needs to be planned for, with the current housing crisis in the regions something that needs to be worked through to ensure that the long-term benefits of a more balanced urban and regional settlement pattern can be sustained, says Professor Gurran. Now, to me, the most critical question of all is, if we are going to invest in the regions, we need to build a mechanism to allow local businesses to grow and develop. And those local businesses can't just be more building and construction, or indeed just more healthcare jobs. We need to support small and medium enterprise in the regions that are actually looking to grow and develop and innovate. That is a whole new ballgame, and I have to say that Ahuri report did not go far enough with regard to considering how small and medium enterprise in the regions could be a catalyst for growth and momentum. Elsewhere, ASIC, the corporate regulator, has switched its focus from cracking down on banks and lenders in previous years to supporting the financial system and Australia's economic recovery. ASIC released its corporate plan for 21-25 on Thursday, outlining its regulatory priorities and actions over the next 4 years, which have been shaped by a new statement of expectations from the government. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has laid out that the government will expect ASIC to contribute to Australia's economic goals, including its recovery from the pandemic, and will work closely with Treasury on the implementation of policy reforms. There are four external strategic priorities for ASIC set out in its corporate plan. Firstly, promoting economic recovery, including through better and more efficient regulation, facilitating innovation and targeting regulatory and enforcement action to areas of greatest harm. Next, reducing the risk of harm to consumers exposed to poor product governance and design, and increased investment scam activity in a low-yield environment. Next, supporting enhanced cyber resilience and cyber security among ASIC's regulated population in line with the whole of government commitment to mitigating cyber security risks, and driving industry readiness and compliance with standards set by reformed legislation, including the financial accountability regime, reforms in superannuation insurance, breach reporting, and the design and distribution obligations. The new agenda has been set amid an internal overhaul for the regulator after the exits of former chair James Shipton and his deputy Daniel Crennan following an expenses scandal. Joe Longo, who became the regulator's chair in April, commented that ASIC will have an important role in aiding the country's recovery from the pandemic, as well as confidence in the financial system. We will continue to take opportunities to support businesses through more efficient regulation. At the same time, we'll continue to be vigilant in protecting consumers and investors from harm, Mr. Longo said. The plan makes no reference to the regulator's previous why not litigate mentality that was adopted after the Royal Commission, with a strong focus on financial misconduct and consequences. But the chair's opening letter in the corporate plan has insisted that ASIC will remain a strong and targeted law enforcement agency and an active litigator against misconduct. ASIC will make use of the full range of regulatory tools available to enhance trust in the financial system, and we will exercise our powers consistently, transparently and proportionately, Mr. Longo said. ASIC has a total funding pool of $462.6 million in 21-22. That's 6% less than the previous year, and is outlined in its recent cost recovery implementation statement. The regulator expects to recover around $337.5 million in total levies across financial industries. Enforcement, supervision and surveillance will account for an estimated 80% of the watchdog's funded activities in 21-22. Around half of the budget has been placed towards enforcement, while 26.4% has been allocated to supervision and surveillance. The effectiveness of ASIC's activities will be monitored by the Financial Regulatory Assessment Authority, the FRAA, a recently formed body that will also watch over APRA. The FRAA started with its first biennial assessment of ASIC and APRA in July, and ASIC also commissioned an external review of its operational functions as part of its work to strengthen its organisational infrastructure. The review considered support functions such as finance, people, development, IT, data and analytics, planning and corporate services. And ASIC has said that it has accepted the review's recommendations and will begin to implement them over the next 12 months. As at 1 July, ASIC had 2,088 employees. That's 27% more than a year prior, and it's flagged that it will recruit more data professionals as it scales up its technology capabilities. And the regulator has plans to implement a data strategy over the next 5 years to help identify threats and harms in the regulatory environment and to set its priorities. And ASIC has outlined four priorities for credit banking providers, which adds to other cross-sector regulatory components, including the DDOs, breach reporting, hawking prohibitions, and internal dispute resolution, institutional supervision, whistleblower programs, remediation, and enforceable cones. In banking and credit, the priorities are consumer leases and short-term small amount finance. And ASIC said it will continue to collect data from relevant lenders and lessors to identify and respond to predatory lending practices. The watchdog has highlighted continuing credit models and other models purporting to be exempt from the National Credit Act. And lender responses to borrowers experiencing financial difficulty, where the regulator is committed to monitoring trends through APRA's data collection and engagement work, and expects to influence how lenders respond to financial hardship through surveillance and setting expectations. And it's warned that it may take action against conduct that exacerbates consumer financial stress. And also poor debt collection practices, where ASIC has said it will collect data to understand the controls in place when debt is sold, how they work, and who is affected, as well as engage with lenders and industry associations. And then also looking at the lending standards of the non-bank lenders. That area, they say, is of lower priority to the regulator, but it has said after legal reform passes, it will engage with APRA to promote consistency about lender obligations, and it will gather information on the industry's implementation. And ASIC also signalled that it will continue to gather data and information from brokers, aggregators and lenders on mortgage best interest duty and conflicted remuneration rules. And file reviews are also on the agenda, as ASIC warned it will take regulatory action, including enforcement, if warranted. Now, the point I want to make here is that ASIC has essentially been emasculated. ASIC did apply considerable pressure post the Royal Commission to the banking sector, but in recent times that has very much been detuned. The latest example, of course, were the issues around responsible lending obligations, which the government tried to remove but failed to get through Parliament. I fear that this change of mandate from the government is essentially a further detuning of ASIC's capability and focus. And giving them a mandate to drive economic recovery and growth is a bit myopic in my view, because the question I've got is who really looks after the interests of those who borrow in the unequal relationship with lenders? And if it's not ASIC, I don't know who it is. We'll see how this plays out, but to my mind, this is a bit of a victory for the big banks and a bit of an intervention directly from government. But the bottom line is that ASIC will have even less teeth than previously. And those teeth were pretty weak at the best of times, because what they tended to do was to basically take large organisations to court occasionally, win small victories with small fines, which frankly were just the cost of doing business. And there was no real accountability down to the individuals who ran those organisations. And unless there is specific accountability relating to the conduct of individuals in those organisations, we will see no change, which means that essentially borrowers are going to be more on their own, and the protections from ASIC, I think, will continue to be detuned. Now, the amount that mortgage brokers get paid may have dropped since the Royal Commission due to the rising costs of compliance and regulations. Average wages for mortgage brokers back in 2018, the last time that a major survey was carried out, was around $86,000 in take-home pay annually. The average earnings taken from a different study in 2016 were around $142,000, with running costs then to be deducted down to an actual wage. The Finance and Broking Association of Australia, the FBAA, has commissioned a new independent piece of research into the state of the industry. CEO Peter White, speaking to Australian Broker, said that while it was impossible to say yet what the average mortgage broker pay was in 2021, his inkling was that the cost of compliance had likely caused it to fall, despite the upswing in revenues that had accompanied the housing boom. I actually think it's gone down, he said. It depends how you want to cut it. In one respect, with house prices going up and LVRs being a percentage of purchase price, brokers are earning more gross revenue. But the cost of compliance has gone up. So when you look at what brokers take home net, they're going backwards. The FBAA has commissioned a second independent report into wages in the broker channel, which is due to be released in the near future, which will factor the new post-Royal Commission price of compliance into the general debate about how much the average mortgage broker earns. At the end of the day, it is as much the cost of business that is going up, said White. The cost of compliance and risk. You have to remember that brokers are on the hook for 2 years because of clawbacks, and you have to provision that risk somewhere on the balance sheet. Increasing costs with ASIC, AFCA and associated risks are all increasing too. As a result of these extra costs, the FBAA hasn't increased membership fees for 3 years because we're trying to assist brokers with increasing expenditures, he said. I can't give a measure on the dollar value, but we know that costs are going up. There's more activity, but there's also more people in the industry compared to 2019, so it's spread out across the whole industry. White recently told Australian Broker that despite some claims in the media and the increasing cost of compliance, brokers were net joining the industry rather than leaving. However, that brings it with the idea that those leaving are generally wealthier brokers who have generated large trail books over time, while those joining are less well off as they begin their journey in the industry. Are average mortgage broker wages being slanted unevenly then towards older and more established brokers and away from newcomers? It's an interesting debate, said White, but my first response is probably not. you've got a lot of people who've been in the industry for a long time, so to swing the balance isn't going to take place overnight. In saying that, there's a constant inflow of people into the business, except through the Royal Commission period when the handbrakes were on. We didn't grow, but we didn't increase either. When that happened and we saw a dip in the numbers, I likened it to a bushfire. The Australian bush survives through the bushfire, but sometimes something has to go through and clean out all the ground. The weakest goes, and what is left behind is a lot stronger going forward. We went through a similar thing, and people that weren't completely in the game got out. They made their decision either because they were close to retirement or only did a couple of loans a year, or they were still debating whether they wanted to be fully in. They made their decision at that time. There was a lot more people who said enough was enough, but that's turned as the strength of the industry resounds into the marketplace. It's a sector that people want to be part of. You're fulfilling people's dreams, and it's great. And of course, you need to be able to make a quid out of it, like any business. To which I would respond that if you look carefully from my analysis, you can see that there's a very strong concentration. Some mortgage brokers are doing exceptionally well at the moment, but there's a long tail that isn't. And given the costs of compliance, which are going up, and given the fact that momentum in the industry could well ease from this point, I expect there to be more of a shakeout ahead rather than growth. But we'll see. And finally, this from Australian broker. Westpac has announced that it has brought back 1,000 Australian jobs from offshore, including its mortgage processing workers, with close to 100% of calls now being answered in Australia by the end of the year. All customer-facing call centre roles are now based in Australia, with offices in Sydney, Adelaide and Melbourne, with new jobs created in those cities. Westpac recently announced the introduction of rapid antigen testing to facilitate their onshore processing teams at their call centre in Concord West, close to the worst of the New South Wales COVID outbreak. Onshoring has been a huge issue as turnaround times have blown out, with many brokers blaming offshore loan processing as a key contributing factor in the slowdown that has occurred during the pandemic and housing boom. CBA were the only big four bank to have their home loan processing based onshore throughout COVID and enjoyed generally quicker turnaround times as a result. We said we would bring 1,000 jobs back, and we have, said Westpac CEO Peter King. COVID has resulted in some of the highest levels of customer contact we've seen, and the new roles are focused on helping our customers manage the impact of the pandemic for both themselves and their businesses. We continue to make changes that bolster how we support customers, and we will shortly have 100% of our customer calls answered by someone in Australia. Great customer service is one of the most transferable employment skills, and we've been privileged to welcome so many high-quality people from different industries to the Westpac team. Now, a couple of points here. The first is that there has been a history amongst the major banks of trying to offshore and then having to bring businesses back to Australia, simply because offshoring does not work. It actually degrades service and increases costs overall. The second is that with the working from home and the distributed systems that are around now, in theory, it should be easier to provide onshore services with high customer experience results. The question is, of course, can they execute effectively to do that? Because my observation generally in Australia is that execution is the problem. There might be an ideal target to try and service customers quickly. But generally, my experience is that in real time, a lot of customers still have a lot of waiting to do and the processes are massively inefficient. There is a real opportunity to digitalise and transform mortgage processing across the industry. And some are better than others. And Westpac, I think, still has a lot more to do. But generally, my perspective is this: bringing jobs back onshore to Australia is actually a good thing. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.